Okay, so last time we wrote down the action for the free massive spin 2 field. And we saw that the structure here was just right so that it has the 5 degrees of freedom propagating, necessary for the description of just the massive spin 2 and nothing else. So now we'll proceed to find the mode functions and quantize this. So the equations of motion could be written in terms of this Wirtz-Pauli system. All the components of the symmetric tensor have to satisfy the wave equation, and it has to be transverse and traceless. So we can write down the general solution, similar to how we did for the massive vector, in terms of mode functions and creation and annihilation operators. Okay, so now we need a complete basis of transverse traceless mode functions, of which there will be 5. So they have to satisfy transversality to the momentum. They have to be traceless. And we want them to be orthogonal and complete. Okay, so on the right-hand side of this completeness relation, this is the unit operator onto the space of transverse traceless tensors. And the most convenient way to construct this basis is to, again, go to this frame where we have some standard momentum, k mu, which is just pointing in the time-like direction, and define a set of transverse traceless polarization tensors in this frame, and then boost them up to our desired momentum. So in this frame, we have the momentum p along which we're going to eventually boost it, and we can decompose this transverse traceless representation into the SO2 subgroup, which is rotations in the plane transverse to this spatial momentum. So this transverse traceless representation is the spin 2 representation. When we break that up along the SO2 that's transverse to the momentum direction, it's going to break up into a helicity 2, a helicity 1, and a helicity 0. So we're going to have the helicity 0 polarization vector is going to be called the longitudinal one. So we write this as follows. So this, we're going to put spatial indices here because this is the set of polarization tensors in the frame, in this standard frame K. So the longitudinal one is written like so. So So this is the unit vector in the direction along which we're eventually going to boost. The helicity plus and minus one polarizations we're going to call vector polarizations. So there's going to be two of them, which I'll index by this A, which goes from 1 to 2. And this is a following expression. Okay, so these, the p hats, the spatial momentum, and v is just a basis of momenta that are orthogonal to the p. And then we have the transverse polarizations, which we won't need explicitly, but for this we're free to choose any basis of transverse traceless tensors in the subspace, which is orthogonal to p hat. So there's two of them in four dimensions. And the properties of these that are important is that when we boost to a large momentum, so we construct the polarization tensor at an arbitrary momentum p by acting with our standard boost matrix, on the standard momentum polarization. And if we do a large boost, the longitudinal polarization is going to behave like p squared over m squared. The vector polarization is going to behave like order p over m, and the transverse polarization goes like order 1. Okay, now we can proceed to write down the propagator. And the numerator of the propagator is just going to be the completeness relation that we found for these polarization tensors. And the key behavior to have in mind is that as p goes to infinity, the propagator now scales like p squared over m to the fourth because of all these p factors here. Okay, from this expression for the propagator, we can see the first sign of what's known as the VDVZ discontinuity, which is that the physics of the massless limit of a massive graviton is not the same as the physics of a massless graviton at the linear level. And that's reflected in this factor of 1/3 that you see in front of this term in the propagator. If we were doing the strictly massless graviton, there would be a factor of 1/2 here. So there's this order 1 difference in factor. And it matters if we're computing things like the Newtonian potential or the deflection of light due to a heavy source. And I won't go through the computation in detail, but I'll just tell you the results. So if we ask for the interaction energy between two sources, so we couple this thing to some conserved T mu nu, and then we ask for the interaction energy. So we put the propagator here between two conserved sources. There's going to be a contribution that comes from the trace, the product of the trace of the two sources, which is order one different between the massless case and the massive case, even in the limit where m goes to zero. And so the predictions you get from this, so if we talk about a large source at rest, like the sun, for one of these t-mu-nus, and the other is a test particle that's also non-relativistic, like the Earth, that's going to tell us about the Newtonian potential. If these are, and these, this Newtonian potential, the sources are going to contribute from this term. If we allow these sources to be, either of those sources to be a light ray, for instance, then this difference in factor here won't matter because it only affects the trace of the stress tensor, and the trace of the stress tensor is zero for light. So if we talk about light bending, so if we take the predictions for massless spin 2, Einstein, linearized Einstein gravity, versus the m goes to zero limit of massive gravity, the light bending angle is exactly the same. So the classic test of light bending is the angle at which if you send a beam of light at impact parameter b around the sun, the angle you get is this, and it's the same in the massive and the massless theory because the light stress tensor is traceless, so this extra factor doesn't matter. The Newtonian potential, however, is different by an order one factor. In the massless case, it's this—it's just the usual Newtonian potential. In the massive case, in the massless limit, it's the Newtonian potential with this extra factor of 4/3. So this immediately tells you that if you're trying to use this as a theory of gravity in the solar system, the linear theory is immediately ruled out because it gets the relative difference between the light bending and the Newtonian potential wrong by this order one factor. And it also violates our physical intuition that parameters, you should not be able to tell by some finite measurement whether a parameter in a theory is mathematically zero or just very, very small. And in this case, you can. Okay, so this goes by the name of the VD-VZ discontinuity after Van Damme, Veltman, and Zakharov. Okay, so we now have all the ingredients we need to write down interactions and start computing amplitudes in the quantum theory. So let's again start with the simplest possible interactions that you might imagine. So let's take the free massive Lagrangian and add an interaction term. And let's write the lowest power interaction term that we can write, an H cubed interaction like this with no derivatives. And let's estimate how the amplitude behaves at large energies. Okay, so if we look again at the four-point amplitude of four gravitons, we're going to now have an exchange diagram like this, where each of these vertices is drawn from this H-cubed interaction. And again, the worst behavior is going to come from this longitudinal mode because it's the mode that grows the fastest as the energy is increased. So the worst divergent behavior comes when we have longitudinal modes for all of the for all of the external particles. And we can estimate how this goes. So we have, for each of the longitudinal modes, we have a factor of p squared over m squared, and there's four of them. We now have two of these interaction vertices, so we have an m squared over m from each of the interaction vertices. And then we have a propagator, which we saw at high energies goes like p squared over m to the fourth. Okay, so this all goes like p to the 10th over m to the 8th m Planck squared. So now we can read off the scale at which this amplitude becomes of order 1 and you violate perturbative unitarity. So we'll write this as p to the 10th over lambda 5 to the 10th, where lambda 5 is this scale that appears here. It's the fifth root of this sort of geometric combination. Okay, so this is the generic scale at which a massive graviton becomes strongly coupled. This is analogous to the scale lambda 2 that we saw for the massive vector. So it's an even lower scale. But it still provides a perfectly fine effective field theory for this massive graviton because the scale at which it becomes strongly coupled is parametrically larger than the mass of the particle you're trying to describe, so long as this Planck mass here is larger than the graviton mass. Okay, but there's now there's a possibility to do better. So in the case of the massive vector, there was nothing really you could do. No matter what interaction you wrote down, the cutoff always went with that lambda 2, and there was really no way to do any better. But now there's the possibility to do better for the simple reason that there's more tensor structures you can write here. So I wrote an h mu nu cubed, but there's other possibilities. You can have an h mu nu squared times trace of h, or you can have a trace of h cubed. And it opens up the possibility that you can have cancellations between these various structures. So there's the possibility to improve on this high energy behavior by canceling off the worst divergences. So we're going to see how to do this. The easiest way to see how to do this is with the Strickelberg approach, which we'll go to next. It's very hard to see how to do this here. You have to calculate these amplitudes and get all the numerical factors right and figure out exactly what you need to cancel, and then you'd have to do the same for the five-point diagrams and all the higher-point diagrams. But with the Strickelberg approach, it'll be almost trivial to see exactly how to improve this high-energy behavior for all the amplitudes. And it'll be easy to see what the best one can possibly do is. Okay, so that's one thing. The other thing is now, once we add this interaction term, if we just look at this term alone, we saw that in the case of the Fierz-Pauli, the linearized theory, there was this Hamiltonian constraint that was enforced by the fact that H0,0, the Hamiltonian was linear in H0,0, so that you had this extra Hamiltonian constraint. Once we have interaction terms like this, we spoil that constraint because now with more powers of h here, it's no longer going to be linear in H0,0. So the full nonlinear theory now propagates an extra degree of freedom. It spoils this constraint. So the full nonlinear theory has 6 degrees of freedom as opposed to the linear theory, which has 5. So that's in the full gravity case that we'll talk about later, that's known as the Boulware desert ghost. Okay, so now, yes.
You just said that it's pulled out by experiment. Are you going to?
Yes, say more about this? I said that the linear theory is ruled out by experiment. Yeah. We'll see that the nonlinear theory cures this discontinuity. So that the linear theory fails as you try to take the mass goes to 0 and then recovers continuity. Okay. Okay, so let's go to the Strickelberg analysis of the full massive graviton. Okay, so just as in the case of the massive vector, our goal is going to be to restore the gauge invariance, which is broken by this mass term. So this linearized theory has the same two problems that we had for the massive vector. It's not continuous as we take the mass going to zero in the Lagrangian. As I set the mass to zero, we have only 2 degrees of freedom, but once the mass is non-zero, it's 5 degrees of freedom, which is not continuous. And the second is problem is the high energy behavior of the propagator. So we want to introduce Stueckelberg's fields again in a way that alleviates both those problems so that we can apply the naive power counting to the effective field theory. And we have a physically smooth mass goes to zero limit. Okay, so we do the same thing we did in the massive vector. We restore a diff invariance by introducing a new vector field, A mu, in a way which is patterned after the gauge invariance that is broken by the mass term, the gauge invariance of the kinetic term, which is broken by the mass term. Okay, once we do this, I'm going to preemptively canonically normalize this vector field A by just putting this factor of 1 over m there. The Lagrangian now looks like the following. So we have a Maxwell F mu nu squared like term coming from this vector field, which you get because of this special Peierts-Pauli structure. The A cubed terms organize themselves into a Maxwell term. And then you have this cross coupling between the tensor and the vector that's suppressed by M. And once we do this, we now have a gauge symmetry. I still have this, yes. Thank you. Okay, and we now have a gauge symmetry. So the gauge symmetry is linearized diffeomorphism symmetry for the tensor H mu nu compensated by a shift for A mu. And we haven't done anything to the physics because I can always choose a unitary gauge where I choose C to set A equals to zero and recover the original theory. Okay, so it's an improvement now because if I take this theory here and I set M to zero in the Lagrangian, I now get a theory with 4 degrees of freedom. I get a free graviton and a free photon, each of which has 2 degrees of freedom. So I'm done slightly better, but it's still not quite there. It's still not quite continuous in the limit. So I have to do one more step and reintroduce also a gauge freedom for the photon. By taking A mu, goes to A mu d mu phi, again with a preemptive canonical normalization. And now, the Lagrangian looks like, I'll just write this as Lagrangian for Peierts-Pauli, which includes all the quadratic and graviton stuff. Okay, so we now have cross couplings between the scalar field and the graviton. And we now have a gauge symmetry. We have both the diff symmetry, and we have a Maxwell-like gauge symmetry that acts, that's a scalar gauge symmetry that acts on the photon, and the scalar shifts to compensate for that. Okay, so we now have a smooth massless limit. If we take m goes to zero, we have a graviton and a photon and a scalar. The scalar is mixed with the graviton, but we'll unmix it. We'll do the next step, we'll unmix it. So it's really, it's the correct 5 degrees of freedom. Graviton has 2, photon has 2, scalar has 1. That adds up to the 5 of the mass of graviton. And in that massless limit, the gauge symmetry reduces to the ordinary diffeomorphisms and the ordinary U1 symmetries of the vector, and the scalar becomes gauge invariant in that limit. So this is implementing at the level of the Lagrangian, the physical limit, where if you take a mass of spin 2 particle and you make it very energetic or you make the mass very small, the spin 2 representation, the mass of spin 2 representation breaks up into a helicity 2, a helicity 1, and a helicity 0. Okay, so with respect to these modes that we found here, the scalar field here is going to carry the longitudinal mode, the vector is going to carry those vector modes, and the graviton, the h mu nu, is going to carry the transverse modes. So we can calculate scattering amplitudes for those various modes by doing it directly in this Lagrangian, as we'll see once we gauge fix in a different way. Okay, we now have to, we want to unmix this mixing between phi and h to show that it's really just a free graviton and a free scalar field. So to do this, we perform a linearized conformal transformation. We take h mu nu, and we redefine it as h mu nu prime plus phi times eta mu nu. And when we do this, the Lagrangian in the massless limit reduces to a free Lagrangian for this new graviton, a free graviton Lagrangian, the Maxwell f mu nu squared, and a normal kinetic term for the scalar field, where I haven't bothered to canonically normalize these things. Okay. This mixing is also the origin, in fact, this scalar field is physically the origin of the VDVZ discontinuity. So if we imagine coupling this to some T mu nu, which is conserved like we did before, when we introduce the Struckelberg fields, these guys drop out if T mu nu is conserved, because the derivative just goes and kills T mu nu. But when we do this redefinition, we find a mixing between the scalar field, phi, and the trace of the stress energy tensor. Okay, so physically this discontinuity is due to the fact that there's an extra scalar degree of freedom that couples to your source and mediates a fifth force. So you have this enhancement of the Newtonian potential is due to this fifth force, and it doesn't affect the light because the trace of the stress tensor for light is zero. Yeah, that's what we're going to do. Yeah. Where did I put that eraser? Okay, so we can take this Struckelberg Lagrangian and we can always get back to the original by doing a unitary gauge, but we want to choose a different gauge, one in which the propagators will manifestly go like 1 over p squared, so that we can do our naive effective field theory power counting. So we impose a generalization of the Lorentz gauge again, just like we did for the massive vector. So the gauge conditions now are going to be the following. And the way you arrive at these is essentially to demand that the kinetic terms all become diagonal, even away from the mass, even away from the massless limit. Okay, so this is a gauge fixing condition for the linearized diffeomorphism symmetry, and this is a gauge fixing condition for the U1s. So if we go through the Fadeev-Popov procedure and introduce gauge fixing, the resulting gauge fixing terms into the Lagrangian, the result is something completely diagonal. So, which looks exactly like the free Lagrangian for a scalar, for a vector field in Lorentz gauge plus this mass term, and for a graviton in Lorentz gauge with this extra m squared. So the propagators now, the graviton goes like goes like so, where you see this factor of 1/2 instead of the 1/3. The vector goes like this, and the scalar goes like the usual scalar. Okay, so all of these now at pi momentum go like 1 over p squared, which is the right scaling to make use of naive power counting in the effective field theory. Okay, so now we can go back to our interaction terms. We can introduce this Stueckelberg stuff into the interactions, expand it all out, and read off the scales of the non-renormalizable terms to determine where things are becoming strongly coupled. Okay, so let's go, let's imagine any sort of interaction Lagrangian, which has no derivatives. So we can imagine the cubic one that we looked at before, and maybe there's higher order ones or different tensor structures of the cubic one. And now we simply make the Stueckelberg replacement of this, which I'll write schematically like so. And you do the same for any power of h that appears higher on. And then we expand all this out, and we see that all the terms are going to be non-renormalizable that involve these extra Stueckelberg fields. They're all derivative interactions. And they're all going to be suppressed by some mass scale now, which are various combinations of this Planck mass and the mass of the graviton. And we can now just read off what the power of that interaction is. Okay, so imagine that I have a term with nh powers of the graviton. I have na powers of the vector field a mu, and each vector field, just by virtue of the Stueckelberg replacement, always comes with one derivative. And suppose I have n phi powers of the scalar, and the scalar always comes with two derivatives. Now, just by counting, I can figure out what power is going to appear in front of that term. So the whole mass term itself comes with this overall factor, and then I have 1m Planck for each H interaction to the power of however many H's are in the term. I have 1m Planck for each of the A's, but also an M because of the canonical normalization of the A.
Is and this big M there? Little M and big M? Yeah.
Yes. There. And then for each phi, I have two powers of little m coming from the canonical normalization, and m Planck like so. So this is the expression for a general sort of term that you get from expanding this. And now I just collect all the powers out front, and I get the following. The scale that appears, I'm going to call lambda sub little lambda, and it occurs with a power like so. And this little lambda, or this lambda is defined as little m to the lambda minus 1, m Planck, to 1 over the power lambda. So, so lambda 2 was the scale that we found for the vector. Lambda 5 was the scale that we found for our generic interaction of the massive graviton. And the little lambda that appears from counting all these powers is the following. Okay, so the higher little lambda is, the lower the scale. So lambda 5 is a lower scale than lambda 2, is a lower scale than lambda 1, and so on. So now we just have to look through all these interaction terms and ask what is the lowest such scale that appears. That's the scale at which the theory becomes strongly coupled, where you violate perturbative unitarity. Okay, so all we have to do is look at this formula and ask for what values of these n's is the scale the lowest. And it turns out that the lowest scales occur for those terms which have only scalar self-interactions. So the lowest terms are for which nA and nH are equal to 0, and you have only scalar self-interactions. So the lowest such scale is where n equals 3. N has to be greater than or equal to 3 because we're only considering interactions. So n phi equals 3 gives us terms that are scalar self-interactions with 6 derivatives, like so. And the scale that suppresses these is lambda 5. So it's these terms which are going to be responsible for the leading behavior of the scattering amplitude that we saw before. If we add more scalar interactions, we have a higher scale. So terms with 4 scalars, like these, have a scale lambda 4. Terms with 5 scalars have a scale lambda to the 3 2/3, and so on. And as we increase the number of scalars, this power gets ever closer to 3 from above. So all the scalar self-interactions have scales lower than lambda 3. And the next higher interactions after the scalar ones don't come in. The other helicities, the A and the H, don't come in until you get to lambda 3. So A and H don't come in until lambda 3. And at lambda 3, we have two types of terms, terms with one power of H and any number of scalars, and terms with two powers of A and any number of scalars. These terms all come suppressed with a lambda 3 scale. The only exception to this is that we have terms with one power of A and any number of scalars that appear at the scale lambda 4. But we're going to see that these are inconsequential in a second. OK, so the general idea and the thing that has led to all the recent interest in massive gravity is the observation that it's possible, by choosing the interactions appropriately, to climb this ladder and cancel off these interactions. So we're going to see that by tuning the cubic interaction, it's possible to kill off these self-interactions of the scalar, which are the...
By tuning, what do you mean?
Just choosing the coefficients of the potential.
So where is that in the description just wrote? Meaning the coefficient of what?
You'll see. Yeah. Okay. The coefficients of the various tensor structures. Yes. One power of A in these, yeah. Thank you.
In the case of the photon, can you go back to the analogy of the photon?
Yeah.
There it was a d phi to the fourth.
There it was a d phi to the fourth, right.
Yeah. So in that case, you didn't want to cancel it. I mean, in fact, the term was not, it was just diverging because, and then you got the heat, right? Why do you want to cancel these terms?
Okay, yeah, so in the case of the photon, interaction was coming in at lambda 2, and it was impossible to do better. By just adding interaction potentials, it was impossible to raise the cutoff higher.
I see, the goal now, what you're doing is, okay, your goal right now in your theory is, I want to raise my cutoff as high as I can.
That's right, I want to do as well as I can in the effective field theory without adding Higgs or anything else. So we're not asking about any UV completion. We're just asking how well can we do just within the effective field theory by choosing the proper interactions.
By the way, and there's the other thing. In the case of the U1 again, mm-hmm. it's a consistent thing. Just the U1, not in a non-abelian group, right? It's a consistent thing to take that. You can even remove that there, right? By taking the depth to infinity while keeping the mass finite.
Yeah.
So there is no such analog here. Is there such trick that you can do to just remove all self-interaction of the digital?
Yeah, I don't think so, because it's not known what the analog of a Higgs would be. Yeah, so maybe if there were, you could, but I wouldn't know without knowing what the Higgs.
You really need to know how the Higgs enters there mm-hmm. to be able to pick up.
Yeah, to ask if there's a limit like that. Okay, so we see that the most dangerous terms are these lambda 3 terms. So let's take a closer look at where those are coming from.
So you're just choosing, basically order by order.
Yep, that's what we're going to do.
Is there a symmetry that imposes that?
As far as I know, no, there isn't.
So even if you choose one to be out of the game, it's not obvious that you'll be able to do at all orders? Can you do it at all orders?
Yeah, that's what we're going to see, how to do it. Okay. So, all right. So let's start. We're going to start with this one. This lambda 5 is the worst offender. It comes only from cubic interactions. So it only comes from terms which are cubic interactions of the graviton. So within the interaction Lagrangian, it's terms which are 3 powers of H. So there's 3 possible structures that we can have. We can have H mu nu cubed. We can have h mu nu squared times trace of h, or we can have trace of h cubed. Those are the only Lorentz invariant possibilities. And these are going to, when we Stuckelberg this, it's going to give us terms that are dd phi cubed, dd phi box phi, and box phi cubed. So,
one more question. But if you close loops of the that will change the kinetic term of the phi.
Yes. Yes.
Is that a consistent procedure? Would that change the sign of the term, or is it?
Yeah, that's right. But when you raise the cutoff like this, it's always a consistent thing to do in the effective field theory, in the sense that the new like additions to the kinetic term that you get, it's going to ruin the structure or whatever. But it always does so at a scale above the cutoff that
so
you've set.
Fine.
So it's always a technically natural choice in that sense.
I see. This is what you were saying the other time.
Yeah.
When you say technically natural.
Yeah, that's right. In the sense
so
that all
when
the.
When they talk about the ghost, when we talk about Pauli fixed gravity, they always refer to the ghost.
That's right,
right,
yeah.
So when is this coming? Or
yeah, that's coming too. Okay. Okay, so this cubic interaction we can see is responsible. We can see now directly from the Stuckelberg language how it's responsible for the high energy behavior of the propagator of the 3-point amplitude that we saw before. So now if we calculate the 4-point amplitude for four of these scalars, which are supposed to correspond to the longitudinal mode, and we ask how this scales where we choose these interaction vertices now. So let me put back these came with, if I include all the proper scales, these always come suppressed by lambda 5 to the fifth power. Okay, so we're going to get, there's no external polarizations to worry about anymore. There's now two interaction vertices, each of which goes like momentum to the sixth over this lambda 5 to the fifth. And there's two of them, so we square it. And now there's a propagator for the scalar, which just goes like 1 over p squared. So we reproduce now our p to the 10th over lambda 5 to the 10th. That we saw from the direct calculation in the unitary gauge. Okay, but now we see exactly how to cancel off this behavior in the sense that we have three of these interaction terms, these three different structures. We're just going to choose the coefficient between these three structures so that all of these cancel into a total derivative. Okay. Question?
So, if that's the strategy, then we have to be careful when the space is not compact.
That's right.
If
it's non-compact, you mean, if there's boundary terms and say.
If you mean when there's curvature, for example, right?
Or like when you get it out, like, this is of course linear, but in the non-linear theory, something like this has to persist, then you should know that.
Yeah, I think what you're asking about is not about linearity or not. It's about the structure of the space-time and whether there's boundary terms you have to worry about. And
well, different boundary. I imagine even, so does it depend on the background you expand on? That's the question. So, for example, does it depend on the geometry you choose, the coefficients, how will they cancel? Are they metric independent?
Yeah, so I can get other contributions. If I did all this on de Sitter space, for instance, now there's when I commute these covariant derivatives, there can be other terms coming from the covariant derivatives. It's background dependent, but it doesn't matter because the only thing that it differs by is commuting the covariant derivatives. The leading higher derivative stuff always cancels anyway because it's only subleading stuff that you'd get from commuting covariant derivatives.
In
the momentum, yeah. Because what we're trying to improve upon is essentially the high momentum behavior, which is short distance local stuff.
Yeah, which so basically it's
always flat. That's right. Yeah. So all this curved stuff is really lower order stuff, and you can do that if you want and keep track of all that
so
in the same kind of thing.
Right? I mean, half the space,
yeah,
the
that's
example,
right.
For example, in the universe, mass of the graviton is intriguingly low compared to the mass of the graviton.
That's right. Yeah. So what I just said is the case where the mass of the graviton is comparable to the curvature. If you start having curvatures that are of the scale of this cutoff, then you don't know what you're talking about because you're beyond the effective field theory. Blah blah blah. But yeah, but I thought what you were asking about was more boundary terms, if I have like a, where I can't ignore the boundary terms, and that's just a big mess, red herring that I will avoid that.
Is there a procedure where you can actually start thinking about like the
G-twilight? Yeah, you can if you like, but generally you don't learn anything by doing this kind of thing. I mean, it depends on what the thing is you actually want to do. Like what do you want to do with this theory? If you want this to be an effective field theory that computes an S matrix for you, then you don't care about this stuff because the S matrix can only be defined in asymptotically flat space anyway. If you want to start doing other things with this, then you may have to worry about these things, yeah. Okay, so, right. So it turns out that there's one combination of these three terms, which is a total derivative, and that's the following combination. Okay, so this means that if we choose our cubic interaction term, to have the same coefficients as this derivative combination, then we will have succeeded in raising the cutoff. Yes, it's the only combination that's a total derivative. So you can check this by just, if you like, you can put an arbitrary linear combination here, take the Euler-Lagrange derivative, and then you'll see that the only way to make the tensor structures cancel is to choose this combination. Okay, so what we've done in the language of Feynman diagrams is to essentially affect a cancellation between, if you were to calculate this same four-point amplitude in the theory with this choice of coefficients, you would see a cancellation among the vertices of these various different structures. This p to the 10th part would just cancel. So if you were doing this back in the unitary gauge, it would be very mysterious why this cancellation is taking place. You would just see these highest powers canceling. But in the Strückelberg approach, it's very easy to see what's going on. It's just that the leading interactions for this longitudinal mode have been chosen to disappear. Okay, so now we're going to, we've now succeeded in eliminating these lambda 3 terms, these lambda 5 terms, and we've got a theory that has at worst a lambda 4 cutoff. We're now going to look at the quartic terms and try to cancel off the lambda 4 contributions, which will then raise the cutoff to lambda 3, and so on, all the way through all the scalar self-interactions until we've eliminated all the scalar self-interactions. And what's left will be a theory that has a cutoff of lambda 3. And we'll see that that is the best that can be done. And we'll study more carefully the theory that you get with this highest possible lambda 3 cutoff and what the structure of that theory is. And the result will be a theory which is sort of a toy version of the full DRGT theory. A toy version in the sense that we started from the linearized kinetic term and then we started to add potentials and asked how well we could do. We will then repeat the same for the full GR. We'll take the full Einstein-Hilbert term and start adding potentials and try to do the same, and the result of that will be the full DRGT theory. So I think this is a good stopping point. And thank you. And when's the next thing? Okay. Is, I guess, Monday?
Monday, what's for me?
What time? Again, 4.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Yes.
So there's no symmetry protecting this combination.
As far as I know, there's no symmetry protecting them. So they will run and change, but they will do so in the sense that any of the sort of pathologies you introduce by doing that will always occur beyond this cutoff that you've set. So by starting with a classical theory that has this higher cutoff, you actually have an effective field theory with that higher cutoff, and it's trustable up to that higher cutoff.
If you've tuned
the classical theory so as to eliminate these terms, then the cutoff of the theory is this, and anything that goes wrong is postponed to this scale. Exactly, that's right. All the loops and things that you calculate will be suppressed by this scale, not the lower scale.
I'm sure that there's no parameters of the mass. Unless you said that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.